All right, we'll have the Marshall Call Court back into session.
The Minnesota Court of Appeals is now back in session. Judge Frisch, Judge Johnson, Judge Bryan, the Honorable Jennifer L. Frisch presiding.
Morning, everyone. Welcome to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. We're here on September 14, 2021 for our fourth case on the calendar this morning, A210319 in the estate of Hazel Bach. Counsel, I'll ask that you mute your microphone if you are not speaking. The marshal is showing a running clock of your time. Please watch the clock to make sure that you present your arguments within the time frame allotted. I'll ask that you identify yourself and your client before you begin speaking. Each of you will have 15 minutes for your primary argument, and the appellant will have an additional 5 minutes for rebuttal if you choose to use that. And with that, counsel, you may proceed.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Kenneth White, and I'm an attorney from Mankato, Minnesota, and I represent the appellant, Lee Johnson, in this matter. This case is an issue of the interpretation of a will, and specifically a line or a couple of lines out of that will in which Hazel Bach writes, "This bequest is conditioned upon Neil C. Johnson and Thomas B. Johnson, or the survivor of the two, making the following payments within 120 days of my death." The district court and the respondents here seek to write out that clause. The clause has two significant pieces to this appeal. The first piece is this bequest is conditioned on the two gentlemen making the following payments. The second clause is making the following payments, again, the overlap of making the payments within 120 days of my death. So what we have here is a situation where Ms. Bach has written into her estate plan, into her will, that there is a condition that must occur before the gift, the devise of roughly 200 acres will occur. And that condition is the making of three payments, the second clause contained in that provision in her will. The first clause is expressly conditional. In order to receive the bequest, you must meet the conditions. Minnesota law is replete with examples, and we go all the way back to In re Miller, the case that respondents and the district court relied upon as controlling authority here, where the Supreme Court states estate plans can be made conditional. And here we have nothing more than a conditional estate plan. Counsel and the district court relied on Miller, but recognized the difference in the language in Miller. There was no conditional language to it. And in fact, the Supreme Court, in analyzing that case, says it doesn't matter whether you consider this conditional or not. It is a directive to make the payment. And whether it comes out of the real estate or the personal property doesn't matter in the end, because it is a directive that the payment has to be made, period, full stop. And they cite the
Ms. White, Mr. White, if I could jump in, please. Are you saying that in reading the briefs and the arguments below, it didn't seem like either party was suggesting that the language was unambiguous, and yet they don't agree on how to interpret multiple parts of the language. So am I correct that you think this is an unambiguous condition precedent?
Yes, Your Honor. I think it's absolutely unambiguous, and respondents and the district court have never argued that there is an ambiguity. And I don't think that the fact that there is different interpretations of language necessarily raises an ambiguity. That the ambiguity issue then opens the door to whether or not outside evidence, collateral evidence outside the four corners of the document can be utilized. And all of the parties, I think, throughout this proceeding have largely agreed that we're confined to the four corners of the will in reaching the interpretation.
So is it Perron? How would you pronounce that name?
I'm not sure, Your Honor. I wasn't involved. I think it's Perrone, but.
Okay, we'll go with Perrone. There's nothing that in the will that gives Perrone or contemplates her willingness to make arrangements, other arrangements, or to even decide not to accept $200,000, to accept something less than that, or to require more than that. There's nothing in this that would give her any agency. Is that correct?
I believe that's correct, Your Honor. And that's really the second argument or the second clause, which is conditioned upon making the following payments. There's no dispute that the first two payments or the two smaller payments, the $2,000 payments, were made within the 120 days. There's also no factual dispute about whether or not the full $200,000 payment to Ms. Perrone was made in a timely manner or within the 120 days. It's undisputed that it was not. Instead, what Ms. Perrone did was have a lawyer, and I hesitate to call him her lawyer because various people thought that Mr. Tanis represented them at various times in this process, but a lawyer or an assistant to a lawyer sent a letter, Exhibit 2, as I recall, which says, you've reached an agreement in principle for the following terms, and here's a check for $50,000. And then the agreement in principle doesn't get finalized until after the February 26th deadline. The agreement in principle also changes pretty dramatically in terms of the number of payments and the time periods. So not only do we not have an agreement within the 120 days that's in writing, we have one that is modified afterwards. And as you point out, there's nothing in the will here that gives anyone the authority to make that modification. And if we go back to Miller, the case that respondents and the district court relied upon, nothing in Miller is conditional. The Miller bequest, the Miller will, has a simple statement. My son shall make the following payments. And the dispute in Miller was the big bequest was real estate, which was transferred prior to the death of Mr. Miller. And so the son came in and said, well, I don't have to make the payments. And the court disagreed and said, no, you have to go ahead and make the payments because there's nothing conditional or otherwise limiting about it. It is a directive that you shall make these payments on behalf of me and the estate. That's decidedly different than the language here, which is expressly conditional, as I pointed out in the first clause.
Mr. White?
Yes.
The district court's order says that three witnesses testified, Sylvia Perrone, Tom Johnson, and Lee Johnson. Did any of them testify about Hazel Bach's intent or intention with respect to that gift in any way?
Your Honor, the testimony was generally that nobody knew about the gift, as I recall, and the conditions that were set on it. And they did testify about her interest in having her two nephews who were actively farming the land and are actively farming it today under, despite this kind of open-ended dispute, that she wanted to have the real estate. And the district court found that Ms. Bach wanted the real estate to go to the two nephews, but she didn't, simply directly deed it. She put this conditional system in place. And obviously an additional intent in her thinking was that time was of the essence. Otherwise, the 120-day provision is unnecessary. And so the 120 days set absolute conditions, which were not met here. And so we think the district court ought to be reversed.
And just to be clear, so did any witness testify about why she included in her will the clause about 120 days?
No, Your Honor.
Okay, thanks.
Mr. White, if I can ask another question. So you're describing this as an absolute condition. 120 days. Are there, as a matter of law, are there some limitations to what conditions can be placed? For example, if it said 120 seconds instead of 120 days, is that still an absolute condition that has to be met?
Well, Your Honor, I think there is a rule of reason in any set, in any condition. There's illegality, there's impossibility. I mean, there are lots of defenses to a condition precedent and whether that condition is enforceable. But there's been no argument here, either below or before this court, that the 120 days in some way met one of those requirements of being unenforceable or unreasonable or otherwise illegal or in any other way impossible. Certainly, I think a provision of 120 days would be subject to a fairly rigorous challenge. And in all likelihood, a 120 seconds, I'm sorry, would be likely to be subject to a fairly rigorous challenge and probably a successful challenge. And then the district court would be looking for a reasonable time. And that would be some number that the district court would have to determine. Here, we don't have that. We have a specific time period, a 120-day limit. And again, there's no claim that that's an unreasonable period or that it was impossible for these young men to meet that requirement. In fact, the Johnsons, it's 200 acres, and even at minimal land values, the land is worth much more than $200,000. And so it would not have been terribly difficult for them to go to a bank and borrow the money and complete the transaction within the 100. So,
I think this will be my last question and I'll let everyone else jump in. But if they had gone to the bank or let's say they just had cash on hand and they gave $200,000 cash, but then they wanted a loan from Ms. Perrone. And so she loans them back $150,000 on certain terms. So they would have to repay that $150,000 loan on the same terms that they now say there was an agreement. Under your interpretation, that would have been completely fine. As long as they transferred something that would meet your definition of payment in the first instance, she could then loan it back to them and they would have this obligation, a mortgage, everything else, security, all that stuff happening in the same way. As long as they handed her the money first, then it would have been perfectly fine?
I believe, Your Honor, yes, because then she has complied with the condition. The condition is to make a payment of $200,000 within 120 days. If she had done that, then whatever other transaction she and her the two nephews of Ms. Bach, the Johnsons, wanted to enter into, that's a private transaction between them that they presumably could have done. And in fact, the law allows that where all of the beneficiaries of a will agree after the will's been read and the property's been distributed to start moving stuff around. There's nothing in the law I'm aware of that would prevent that. But that's not what happened here. What happened here in...
Counsel, I want to ask you, what you're asking for a reversal and a remand, but what do you want the remand order to look like? What happens to this? Does it go to the residuary and do you need an order or does it go back to pro? What would you like us to do?
In the end, Your Honor, we're asking you to reverse and to remand it because then the estate is still open. The 200 acres would, roughly 200 acres, would then go back into the will, and under the terms of the will, that gift would fail, and thus it would drop into the residual estate and be distributed to the nieces and nephews as set forth in the residual clause. There's about 10 of them. And there are other issues that are still percolating around in terms of dividing out the building site that Lee Johnson receives and so forth. So there's other issues still in this estate that are kind of on hold while this court deals with the 200 acres.
And the fact that there are other beneficiaries to the estate potentially, is that another reason why Ms. Perrone was essentially unable to waive the requirement of payment?
Yes, Your Honor. I think if you spin a different hypothetical, and Ms. Perrone had gone to all of the beneficiaries and said, well, folks, I don't need the cash. They don't have the cash. Is it okay with you if I enter into this loan agreement within 120 days and get all the paperwork put together within the 120 days and everybody had signed off on it, then I think you would have a real estoppel issue, if nothing else, for anybody trying to challenge that once they've had the opportunity to evaluate that decision and have independent counsel and all the other stuff. That wasn't done here, obviously. Instead, this was done in secret. Lee Johnson didn't find out about this agreement until he saw the March bill from Mr. Tanis's office, which went to the estate for payment, and it included time for preparing all of these documents. And so this was not an agreement that everybody was out there trumpeting and making very public. So, Your Honor, we would ask that this court reverse and remand and direct the district court to proceed through the will and have the 200 acres deposited into the residual estate.
Thank you very much, counsel. You'll have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Mr. Sandquist.
Thank you, Judge. May it please the court. My name is Christopher Sandquist, and I represent respondents Thomas and Neil Johnson. The primary issue before this court is whether the conditional bequest by Hazel Bock is controlled by 100-year-old Minnesota Supreme Court precedent and subsequent holdings specific to issues as to how to interpret and apply conditional bequests with required payment of legacies, or whether or not more general law applicable to non-probate matters or contingent of various contingency types are applicable to this primary issue. The holding in N. Ray Miller Estate from 1917 makes clear that when there is a conditional bequest that requires the recipient of the bequest, normally we find it in real estate or some other type of property, that they must make a payment of a legacy to somebody else. When the person does that, the devisee takes the land charged with the payment as a legacy, and also by accepting the devise, he assumes a personal liability to make the same. Lundquist, which was a subsequent case in 1935, states and reaffirms the Miller holding that the cases cited in Miller, it is well settled that in a case such as this, the property coming to the two sons is charged with the payment of this obligation. The subsequent court case of Kornstrom versus Murphy in 1979 again affirmed the rule of law found by the Miller court, that it is well settled that a devise conditioned upon the payment of money to a third person creates an equitable charge rather than a trust. The third person thus acquires a security interest in the charged property.
That's not how this will was drafted. This will was drafted in a way that title to the property doesn't transfer unless and until three specific payments are made within a specified time period. So, I mean, my understanding is that you're claiming that this will is unambiguous. Is that right?
That is correct.
Okay. So what is the language in the will that allows title to transfer when the payment hasn't been made within 120 days, when the three payments have not been made within 120 days?
It is, Judge Frisch, the applicability of the N. Ray Miller holding that to any conditional bequest, that the condition is not the performance of the payment obligation. It is that is a separate issue. The condition of a conditional bequest since 1917 has been acceptance merely of the obligation to make the payments. The payment and the timing of any of those payments becomes an issue for, as the court in Kornstrom said, for the third party. And the cases in the line of cases read together simply say, in order to meet the condition precedent that the bequest is conditioned upon, that language in and of itself creates the condition precedent, and that then the payment terms follow, that they shall make the payments within 120 days, and then the three additional subparagraphs set forth the amounts. The acceptance creates the title in them. It allows for the transfer of the property subject to, however, the land being transferred, being charged with the requirement that within 120 days, the sum of $200,000 be paid to Sylvia Perrin and that the two other ones be paid as well. And what that means is, again, reading through the case law, if there is a complaint about a late payment or a complaint of a non-payment, it is not the complaint of the estate. It is the complaint and the right of the recipient of the legacy to be able to sue, to foreclose on the equitable lien, to be
But in this case, there are other beneficiaries to the estate that have an interest in ensuring that timely payment is made. And if timely payment is not made, then those other beneficiaries have a right to that property. So why isn't that a distinguishing characteristic from these other cases that you're citing as well?
Because I Judge Frisch, I believe that the order of well, this is why I believe that In re Estate Miller and its progeny allow for the transfer of the land to avoid just that problem. It allows for the transfer of the land subject to the equitable lien and allows transfer to the obligors, the conditional bequest recipients of a personal charge against them. We then don't have to worry about, well, what would have happened if the bequest would have failed. We don't have to worry about what about all of the other potential takers under either the will or under the there was, you know, some other entities that were out there entitled to it. It simply becomes a matter of if you accept the obligation, you get the title, but that title is encumbered, and you accept.
So your argument is that as long as they say we'll pay you $200,000 at some point in time, we get the property. That's your interpretation of the will under Emory Miller's estate.
Absolutely. And it makes sense if one thinks through all as you were.
And then what happens if they don't pay?
Then in this case, Ms. Perrin would have the right to sue to foreclose on the equitable lien on the farmland, and would have the ability to sue Tom and Neil Johnson directly for the payment of that legacy. It's a matter that In re Miller created a different way to enforce it than what is suggested by the appellant.
And you're saying that the other beneficiaries of the estate are completely cut out as long as they say we're going to pay $200,000.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Mr. Sandquist, this legal theory that the acceptance of the obligation is key, not the payment. I don't see that in the district court's order. Would you agree with me?
The district court did spend an inordinate amount of time, in my opinion, trying to interpret intent. And she did find that In re Miller's estate is clear that the condition, the acceptance of the obligation is a prerequisite to it, and it drives it. But she focused a fair amount on the intent and the testimony that she did have concerning that it's not unreasonable for someone to want the renters to be the persons in the property, the focus on that the specific language that was chosen in the will did not immediately say what would happen if the bequest failed, if Thomas and Neil Johnson decided, nope, we're not going to pay any of these legacies. The district court focused on the language talking about only if both Thomas and Neil Johnson predeceased her, would then there's specific language saying that this farmland drops into the residual of the state. So that was the district court's way of getting to that there would have been a different requirement for under those circumstances that apparently was in Ms. Bach's mind as she was setting forth what she wanted in her will, as opposed to the simple proposition that, hey, there are all these potential traps out there. And in the event that Tom and Neil do get caught up in one of those traps, they lose the farmland and the other 10 or 13 heirs get a chance to get the farmland between themselves. So if we take a look at the alternative argument, which is that, as suggested by the appellants, that there is, that if payment is not made, that voids or vacates or in some way terminates the conditional bequest. I would suggest that why would then the Minnesota Supreme Court in the three cases have spent so much time talking about equitable charges, have spent so much time talking about that the where the property is devised with such a charge, the devisee may also become personally liable to pay the amount of the charge. If it's simply a matter of the conditional bequest failing, that is all superfluous language that the Supreme Court on three occasions has said is well-settled law. The appellant's argument in that context makes no sense. Gifts and devisees are different. The laws of gifts and devisees are different. The condition of the payment of the bequest is the acceptance or rejection of the obligation to pay the legacies. If it was anything more, if it was whether they actually do and everything is contingent upon it, or even in this case, where it must be paid within a timeline, then again, it makes no sense as to why we create equitable charges, why we create personal charges. Ms. Counsel suggests that it is an issue of it's an In re Miller, that this is not a conditional one. Well, the court apparently thought it did because that's the law it started with. And remember, a conditional bequest, there is always the ability of those who are given the option to pay the obligation to say no. And in In re Miller's estate, the question was, well, can they do that essentially because the decedent had already given out the land? So it's, while there is not the usage in the will that my son must do it upon condition. In fact, I believe the In re Miller estate court even said it wasn't the most perfect language chosen, but it is clear if that legate received the property that he must pay the condition, he must pay. And that if he didn't, it created an equitable charge upon the property and it created a personal charge upon himself. So it is not as simple as to say, well, all they have to do is say yes, because saying yes and accepting it has additional ramifications concerning their obligations to make the payment to themselves and to the property. There was also much time spent suggesting that the payment agreement reached by my clients and Ms. Perrin somehow ran afoul of the will.
Before you get to the payment issue, Mr. Sandquist, if I may, what do you think Ms. Perrin's choice was? What options did she have?
Her option was to accept payment for the property. It was not clarified in the will as to what would constitute that payment. As agreed to by Lee Johnson himself, something other than cash would be acceptable forms of payment. Payment of gold or payment of farm property or payment of stocks or negotiable instruments would also constitute payment. The suggestion that cash...
So let me follow up, because what happens in your argument then if she refuses to accept payment?
If Ms. Perrin refuses to accept payment, she always has the option to disclaim any entitlement she has under the will.
Right, but I'm saying what happens to the real property? Because the condition doesn't get met. She doesn't accept payment. What happens? Is it the Johnsons for free? What happens?
If she believes that she has not received what she believes is payment under the will, she has the right to foreclose.
No, that's not my question. My question is, if she refuses to accept payment, because I asked you what were her options and you said her option was to refuse payment. So she does not accept payment.
Okay.
What happens to the real property?
In other words, if she believes that she doesn't want the payment or that she does not need the $200,000, then in that particular instance, the farmland remains in the hands of Thomas and Neil Johnson, because under Miller, it's already been transferred to them. And if she chooses not to take any election to enforce that, the equitable lien, or if she changes her mind at a later time, she has the right to say, I'm good. And in fact, the testimony was at the trial in this matter, after my clients went to the bank and began to make arrangements, she said, you know what, I'll give you better deals because I don't need the money up front.
I'm just trying to make sure I understand the theory here of the Perrone's options and what that this is a decision she makes and somehow contingent on her. So if she accepts payment, then the real property would be with the Johnsons. And if she refuses to accept payment, then the real property is still with the Johnsons?
If she accepts payment, the property is with the Johnsons, subject to an equitable lien on the property and a personal charge against both of the Johnsons. If she declines to accept payment, then the property remains with the Johnsons, and the debt obligation otherwise that would attach never is collected. The IRS probably will figure it some sort of beneficial income, but with respect to her, if she doesn't take it, then she elects not to. With that, we would ask that the order of the district court be affirmed, that the appellant be rejected with respect to the relief that they sought, and the district court be affirmed in this matter. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Sandquist. Mr. White, you're muted, sir.
Mute buttons. I will never get used to them. thank you, Your Honor. There are 2 points that I think are important to be made here in response to the argument by Mr. Sandquist. First, the argument of Mr. Sandquist completely ignores the language of the will. There is no dispute that under the law, this court is left to interpret the language of the will and not to change or insert new language into it. And that's exactly what Mr. Sandquist is arguing.
Do you think that the unambiguous language of the will writes around this concept of an equitable lien on the property?
Yes.
And tell me why.
Well, because the specific bequest is conditioned upon the Johnsons making the following payments. Conditioned upon. And so when Ms. Bach wrote her will, she didn't say conditioned upon their acceptance of the transfer and a personal obligation to pay it sometime in the future, or directly gift the land to them, which with then, as in Miller, an obligation for them to pay $200,000 out of their own whatever their residual rights were under the will and or their own personal property, which is the New York case that preceded or that Miller relied on. Instead, what she did is she used conditional language, and she made the bequest of the real estate conditioned upon the making of the payments. And what the argument of the respondents here today would do, and the finding of the district court, is it would write that completely out. Then there is no condition of making the following payments. Instead, it's conditioned upon making an acceptance.
So if I'm hearing you correctly, the key word here is the making of a payment instead of the promising to make a payment. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct, Your Honor. The will is very specific. It doesn't say promise to make or simply tell me that you're going to accept the real estate and you got to make these other payments somewhere down the road, which was the situation in Miller and in the New York decision that preceded it. And I'm sorry, the names floated out of my head. But if you And so if you look at this will and this language and interpret it within its four corners, which is the obligation of this court, you cannot change the language of the will, which is what the respondents are attempting to do. Second of all, the respondents argue that all of the discussion in Miller and its progeny about equitable liens and personal obligations and equitable charges would not, none of that would make a difference under the theory that we're espousing here. And that's, again, simply not true. The equitable charge language applies where there is simply a directive to make the payment, not where there is a obligation based on a conditional gift. So you end up with two categories of charges, if you will, to individuals who are going to receive the gift. One is, thou shalt make a payment. That's Miller. The other is, if you want the land, you have to. It's an if-then statement to take you back to your high school or college logic classes. And so if you want the real estate, then you must do the following. And here, it is conditioned upon payment, not conditioned upon promise to pay. It is conditioned upon payment within 120 days. And the evidence is simply undisputed that that payment wasn't made within 120 days. So again, Your Honors, we would ask that this court reverse and remand the case to the district court with directions to find that the gift of the real estate to the Johnsons fails, and that the 200 acres, give or take a bit, would fall back into the residual estate and be distributed accordingly.
Thank you very much, counsel. The matter is now submitted and we'll issue an opinion within the statutory time period. And with that, we are in recess. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Your Honor.